This Texas Matters podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the number of migrant families crossing the southern border continues to climb. Is this the border emergency? What to make of these numbers? And the border stretches from the wall to Wall Street. Action writer Don Winslow takes on the Trump White House in his latest action thriller. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. This week, the reported number of families looking to gain unauthorized entry into the United States again broke records. More than 76,000 migrants crossed the border without authorization in February, an 11-year high. Kevin MacLean is the Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection.
It should be very clear from these numbers that we are facing alarming trends in the rising volumes of people illegally crossing our southwest border or arriving at our ports of entry without documents. This increased flow presents, currently at our highest levels in over a decade, both a border security and a humanitarian crisis, challenges our resources and personnel, and is negatively impacting border security. We're also seeing stark increases in asylum seekers as we work to provide lawful and safe access at our southwest border ports of entry. In fiscal year 2018, we saw a 120% increase over fiscal year 17 with 38,000 claims at Southwest Border ports of entry. Taken together, these numbers are remarkable. 76,000 total apprehensions and inadmissible arrivals in a four-week month in February. That's the highest number of encounters in any February in the last 12 years.
And he said the way migrants are coming to the southern border is also changing.
Not only are the numbers increasing, the percentage of people from countries in the Northern Triangle of Central America has increased as well. Now 70% of all crossings are from these countries. Guatemalans and Hondurans are both crossing now in larger numbers than Mexican nationals. Families and children from Central America require increased care and processing and are released into the United States pending adjudication of their immigration claims. We see a new phenomenon of large groups of mostly family units from Guatemala who are traveling on buses through Mexico to the U.S. border in much shorter smuggling cycles, making the journey in as little as 4 to 7 days and on a very consistent basis. And smugglers are dropping these groups in the most remote areas of our border.
The Trump White House reacted to the stats, calling this a massive surge and a clear confirmation of the need for a border wall and for a national emergency to build the wall without the funding approval from Congress. Oor Jadu is with America's Voice, a progressive advocacy group for immigration rights.
It's not a massively increasing number. What it is instead is a changing demographic of crossers. So while there is a steadily changing demographic, the overall numbers are still quite low, nowhere near what we saw in 2000, which was 1.6 million. So we're still at pretty low numbers. In just the first 5 months of this fiscal year, the total apprehensions are still at 268,000. And last year, it was 397,000. So nowhere near the 1.6 million.
Still, we're seeing a lot of arrivals on the border, and these tend to be women and children coming up from Central America.
That's correct. That is the change.
And the reaction to that, from Texas Senator John Cornyn, he says that this is a crisis. And he says people who deny that there is a crisis and who describe this as a fake emergency at the border or do not understand what is actually happening. They say they have to be blind to the facts or simply unwilling to listen.
So that's incorrect. So the new demographic, as you just stated, is a humanitarian issue. Let me quote from the Migration Policy Institute. They said this: The decades-long flows of largely young Mexican males crossing illicitly and evading the Border Patrol have been replaced by Central Americans fleeing a mixture of violence and poverty. So massively increasing numbers, no. A changing demographic, and the demographic happens to be a humanitarian issue. Humanitarian issues don't require declarations of national emergency, military deployments at the border. That's not what a humanitarian issue calls for. A humanitarian issue requires a humanitarian response.
President Donald Trump says illegal immigration is not compassionate. It is inhumane, unjust, and cruel. And his solution to dealing with that, providing the humanitarian crisis at the southern border, is he wants to deter people from attempting to cross.
Well, the first thing they can do is stop limiting those numbers of people they are processing at ports of entry. Instead of solving the real crisis that we are experiencing, people attempting to find a way to turn themselves in and say, where can I apply and how may I be able to participate in an efficient process that can get me through the system to see if I am eligible? That is not happening. Instead, you're seeing limits of people being processed, sending people using this very obscure provision in our immigration law, sending people back to Mexico to wait in what the New York Times described recently, camps that are fetid misery, where people are suffering. That is not a good government response to a humanitarian problem, an issue at our border with our southern neighbors.
Oor Jadu is with America's Voice, a progressive advocacy group for immigration rights. All that is happening along the southern border is certainly ripe for harvesting for storytellers. There is mystery, crime, heroes, and villains. This is rich territory for someone like Don Winslow, a New York Times bestselling author of action thrillers. His latest book is The Border, and it is a conclusion of a trilogy that explores the American drug war. But his latest book is more than just a page-turner. It's an examination of many of the issues confronting American politics, from security at the southern border, the handling of immigrant children, the opioid crisis, how Wall Street is profiting from all this, and those who would exploit fears of the other for political gain. I asked Don Winslow about his role as a storyteller in these deeply partisan times.
Basically, I'm a crime writer. I write crime fiction. I embrace that genre. I don't run from it. But yeah, it's definitely about our times. And I hope that, you know, in reading this book, that people will get a better understanding of some of the things that are going on.
The border is a big thing. And actually, it's a lot of things. It's not just the delineation between one country and another. It's where two countries come together, and it's also metaphorical.
Well, it is. You know, I mean, a lot of the book is set along the physical border between the United States and Mexico, but it has a lot more to do, I hope, with internal borders, you know, political borders, ethical, moral borders, emotional borders. What are we willing to cross and what are we willing, you know, not to cross? And once we cross them, can we ever come back?
So at your previous books, a lot of action, a lot of thrilling, and those tend to be read by a lot of like a lot of red meat men who enjoy that type of stuff. And those people might be owners of red caps that have Make America Great Again written on them. It just seems to be maybe you're taking on some of their concepts of what is the border.
Yeah, listen, I mean, I don't know that I'd agree with the description of the first two books as sort of red meat books. There's certainly a lot of action in them, but there's a lot of action in them because they talk about real events that actually happened in the war on drugs over the last 50 years. To your larger point, yeah, I'm not sure that I have a lot of fans with red hats. In fact, I've been told they're going on Amazon to give the book one star because they hate me so much.
Yeah, I noticed that. I noticed they say that you used to be a good writer, but then you got Trump derangement syndrome.
Well, I think the country got Trump derangement syndrome when Trump was elected, but I'll let that slide. Look, if they want to do that, they're welcome to do it.
Other people are giving you 5 out of 5 stars. Most others, many others on the Amazon, and they're saying that it's a great ride, a great adventure ride, a great novel, a great tale, but also rooted in reality in a way that gives it substance and weight.
Yeah, listen, I hope so, you know. I mean, I write about our times. I write about contemporary issues. What I was trying to do with the novel is a couple of things. One, to bring the drug war home. You know, in the first two books, most of the action takes place in Mexico. In this book, most of it takes place here in the United States. I wanted to try to get underneath the headlines. You know, headlines become labels. So, you know, the opioid epidemic, the immigration crisis. I wanted to try to take a more individual look and let the reader see that through the eyes of people who are undergoing those experiences.
The United States has a history of using fiction storytelling to highlight current events. And like you can think Uncle Tom's Cabin. You know, was informative at its time. The Jungle, informative of its time and still read today. I like to think of sometimes of, this is not a term that people hate, but I like, investigative fiction, where you are telling a story of fictional characters, but the canvas that they are on is definitely been investigated and will hold up to truth squatting.
You know, I've never heard that expression before, but maybe I'll pick it up. Maybe I'll use it. You know, again, I'm a crime fiction writer, but I like to write about realistic situations. I think my job is to take the reader into a world that he or she couldn't otherwise go, or at least to help them see it maybe a little differently, give them a little different perspective. So if that's investigative fiction, yeah, I embrace that.
When we're talking right now about a national emergency declared by a presidential order about the border, and I think a lot of the conflict that we have in the country today is based on the fact that a lot of people don't understand what a border is and what it actually does. Do you think if someone reads this book that they're going to get a better understanding of how the border functions?
Well, I hope so. I mean, look, there's a lot of sort of practical information in the book. For instance, the fact that 90% of the illicit drugs coming into the country from the southern border come in through ports of entry, legal entry points. There are 52 of them along that border, three of which really matter. And so I don't think people realize that most of the drugs come through gates that the wall, proposed wall, wouldn't affect at all. I would also like, I hope it shares a perspective that while a border is something that divides two entities, it's also something that the two entities have in common. You know, we also share a border, and it's important to realize that. And three, you know, when we talk about this border area, you live in it, you know, it's been bicultural since before there was a border.
There's an attitude today in the United States fed by certain media enterprises that want people to believe that the border, it's an open border. We hear about a war zone border. They don't really talk about that this is where people live and they love being on the border.
Well, exactly. You know, I've lived on the border for 22 years, and that sounds like a dramatic statement. I mean it literally, physically. I live in a border town and a border area. I've never seen any of this war zone stuff. The other thing that I hate about what we're doing is we won't for any of this alleged chaos. Those border plazas on the other side of the border are violent because they're drug transshipment points, where, you know, the cartels use to bring drugs into the United States. But we won't take the responsibility for wanting those drugs. We're the consumers. We're the buyers. You could stack up drugs on the American side of the border till it sinks, you know, and it wouldn't make a difference if we didn't want those drugs. But I think that there's a profound misunderstanding of the border area and what it's like and how varied it is. You're talking about 2,000 miles. So there are differences.
And talk about how you were able to get into the shoes of the characters of DEA and also people who come up from Central America. You have a very strong character, Nico, who did that, La Bestia, the train, and became, you know, these are people that the reflections of the abstract stories that we hear about, you know, caravans and things like that.
Well, you know, sort of like you, I've been on this beat for 20 years, you know. So when I first started researching this, it was a lot of documents that I read, a lot of history, a lot of journalism. And there's been great journalism and nonfiction, you know, written about all of this. At a later point in time, though, it became more a matter of talking to people. You know, one person introduces you to another. You know how it works. That kind of networking to try to get the sense of nuance, the sense of language. Not so much asking, you know, what did you do, but what did you think about it? How did it make you feel? You know, the smaller touches that hopefully make this a novel and make it more human.
In your storytelling, you pepper a lot of the dialogue with Spanish, and frequently editors or publishers will push back on that, and they say, well, I don't know if they're going to get this or what you're saying, and you don't really... it helps to understand what a pobrecito and all these other words in that you have. What kind of pushback did you get on that?
Yeah, just what you said. You know, I do get some pushback on it. Some of it I listen to, others I don't. I try to, especially in dialogue, set it in context so that any kind of reasonable reader would understand what's being said there. Sometimes it's better to use the Spanish or the Spanglish word. Other times, though, I've taken it out because I've realized that I'm just being presumptuous, you know, that really, of course, the entire conversation would be in Spanish. So, you know, maybe there's not so much of a point of using one or two Spanish words. And then I kind of laugh at myself and take it out.
But it does add a lot of color and context and authenticity to the dialogue.
I hope so. And what I really hope it adds is rhythm. You know, in writing any dialogue, I think what we're trying to catch is the music of that and the rhythm that makes a difference. And so, yeah, sometimes those words really help set the rhythm and the inflections.
In 20, 30, 40 years, maybe even longer, when people try to figure out this crazy time that we're in today, and if someone says, this book will explain it to you, read The Border by Don Winslow, what do you think is going to be in that book that really captures the moment?
Boy, that's a really good question, Dave. I hadn't thought about it that way. You know, I think that they will find a historically accurate world. I think that they will find a certain kind of mentality that's going on right now. And I just, again, I hope that it just brought them into a world that they otherwise couldn't go into in 30 or 40 years from now from obvious reasons.
And
I guess that's not a really great answer, but it's the one I have right now.
Well, stories, narratives, this is how we communicate. The things are so big right now and so in front of us, it's hard for many of us to get a grip on why are things happening the way they are. You look at it from the wall to the Wall Street and what's in between the two, and you find out that there is a connection.
There's a definite connection. You know, again, we're the consumers. We're the people who send $65 billion a year of dirty money down to Mexico in exchange for drugs. The Mexican economy can't possibly absorb that much money or launder that much money. A lot of it comes straight back here, and it's invested in lending institutions and banks and real estate and legitimate businesses. There's a definite connection. The other big money connection is what, for lack of a better expression, we could call the prison industrial complex. Drug trafficking is big business, but anti-drug trafficking is also big business in terms of equipment, police, courts, lawyers, prisons, all that goes with it. It's big money. So there's a very strong connection from the soil in which, you know, the individual poppy is grown and big money and big power in Washington and New York.
Yeah, these border towns, they're company towns, and you have members of the same family frequently who are, some are moving the drugs across, and the other members of the family are working to keep the drugs from moving across, and they all sit down together and get along just fine. They all realize it's just a way of doing things.
It's a symbiotic relationship. One depends on the other.
You have a character in the book who seems to be a very familiar sort of a parody of the president that we have now, Donald Trump, President Dennison.
And yeah,
he tweets, yeah. He's a blowhard, he is exploiting people's fears. That seems to be, you know, when we hear that from your anti-reviewers on Amazon that you have Trump derangement syndrome, that you are doing a fictional hit piece on the president with this thriller, why go there?
Well, I'm writing about our times. The book actually starts during the Obama administration, by the way, and takes a few hits at him, by the way, as well. But I am writing a contemporary book, so it would be foolish to pretend that there's any other president. You know, it'd be foolish of me to pretend it's President Martin Van Buren or Abraham Lincoln or FDR or anybody else. We have the administration that we have.
And we have to acknowledge that we have a chief executive of the nation who is willing to do things in an unconventional manner in order to achieve goals that we aren't familiar with coming from the Oval Office?
Listen, I don't mind if he uses unconventional methods, and that's not my problem with Mr. Trump. My problem with Mr. Trump is he goes out on campaign and tells parents of, you know, kids who've died of drug overdoses that he's going to solve that problem by building a wall, when he knows absolutely that that's not true. That's a problem I have with Mr. Trump.
So you've taken a full page ad out in the New York Times talking about the drug war and being, you know, talking truth to, you know, those methods.
You know, every year and a half or 2 years, David, I have a window because I have a book coming out where some people might listen to me a little bit. So during those times, I feel, yeah, responsibility might be too strong a word, but some obligation to do what I can about the issues that I'm writing about. Otherwise, I think maybe I'm just a voyeur, you know. So I've taken out full-page ads in the Washington Post advocating the legalization of drugs. I took out a full-page ad that you alluded to in the New York Times objecting to Mr. Sessions, the former attorney general, wanting to return us to the era of maximum mandatory sentencing and mass incarceration. These are issues that I feel pretty strongly about. They're in the books. So at those moments when I have an opportunity, yeah, I do what I can.
And you have a character, Nico, comes up from Guatemala, rides the Bestia train. He wants to come to the United States, and you paint him in a very sympathetic way. Were you trying to give readers an idea of what these people are, who these people who are coming to the United States, what their common story is?
Sure, absolutely. Now listen, you know, books are like babies, you know, they're 9 months in gestation or a little longer. I wrote all the Nico chapters before the present caravan issue, to shorthand it. But this has been going on for a long time. As I said, actually, Nico comes up during the Obama years. And I want readers, it's a good story, right? But I definitely want people to know what these people's lives are like. This kid is living in a garbage dump, you know, gets his food from a garbage dump, is threatened by the gangs with death unless he joins, and decides to leave and comes up and takes that extraordinarily dangerous trip up through Mexico, only to be arrested at the American border. And so I do want the reader to know what these people's lives are like, that we don't just look at them and accept some sort of characterization that they're criminals and murderers and rapists.
Yeah, I went to Honduras and hung out with the street kids in Tegucigalpa for a week and saw kids just like Nico. But then, you know, all around us are all the signs of American prosperity, all the fast food joints.
Well, exactly. And these gangs, you know, MS-13 and Kai 18, and they're like, you know, were not born in Central America. They were born here in the United States. So this is not an invasion. It's a boomerang.
So MS-13, we hear a lot about, that's another reason why we need a wall to protect us from gangs. And MS-13 is being presented as if it were an existential threat to the United States. Do you see that as a reality?
Well, listen, I mean, MS-13 is a horrible gang, a horrible, sadistic gang who've done terrible things. But there's no invasion of MS-13 into the United States. And according to the FBI, MS-13 membership in the United States, most of whom are American citizens, by the way, make up less than 1% of gang members in the country.
So you write this book, The Border. Do your readers have a hunger, do you think? Are they telling you? I'm sure you're in dialogue with many of them. They're trying to figure out what is going on. And it helps them to find an entertaining book, a joyride of an action thriller, to kind of help them get a better understanding of what's driving our politics right now from a trusted source like you, Don Winslow, because they know that you've done the foot leather work to bring this together.
Yeah, I hope that's the case. You know, listen, I mean, again, I'm a crime fiction writer. That's my job number one, is to write a good, interesting, exciting story. If in doing that, I can help the reader understand more about what's going on in this world, then I'm very pleased.
And it's so easy to be pulled into the excesses of the story of the border. I know from my experience down there, and I tell people my war stories of you know, seeing shootouts and things, they get all scared. And I said, no, it's not that bad. And now that your book's going to be turned into like a movie or a TV series, it's this book's got huge legs. It's going to be all over the place. Are you concerned about it being turned into something actually telling the story that you don't want it to tell?
I think that's always a concern. I think that's always a risk, you know. I think that we walk a very fine line between legitimate writing and sort of the pornography of violence or sensationalism. I hope what sets my books apart is a deeper look from the inside of some of these characters' minds and hearts. Actually, in terms of this book, more that takes place in the United States than takes place in Mexico. It's more about our experience here, the opium epidemic, corruption in high places, police work, and that kind of thing. But I think, you know, David, I think that's always a risk. One of the problems with writing about the cartels, and I think especially one of the problems with filming the cartels, is that it's already surreal. And then that when it gets blown up and put into, you know, kinetic action and living color and all of that, it only gets more surreal to the point where it becomes unbelievable. But I think that the antidote to that particular poison is to take the time to get to know the characters, take the time to reveal their thoughts, take the time to show different aspects of Mexican culture and society, which I've certainly tried to do in these books. And to take a deeper look at it, you know, rather than just have another action thriller.
Don Winslow is the author of The Border, a follow-up to two other bestsellers, The Power of the Dog and The Cartel. The FX Networks acquired the rights to turn the trilogy into a TV series. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters episodes, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.